Hi, and welcome to the Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the closing of the last Old Country Buffet restaurant in Indiana. Justin Hicks reports the Indiana Department of Workforce Development is trying to speed up the process for resolving disputes about unemployment eligibility. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer with a look back at the important financial issues of 2020 and putting them into perspective as we look into 2021. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Indiana State Police completed a two-year-long investigation and filed felony charges against two Lake of the Four Seasons security officers for impersonating law enforcement officers. The level six felony charges are against 21-year-old Adam Wood of South Haven and 23-year-old Michael Amata of Portage. There are also charges filed against the Gated Communities Property Owners Association. 2 years ago, state police investigators raided the main security building at the main entrance of Lake of the Four Seasons, located near Winfield. At issue were potential criminal offenses related to traffic stops made by the security guards. In September 2018, the emergency vehicle authorizations for Lake of the Four Seasons Property Owners Association were revoked because officers were using red and blue flashing lights that are only authorized for police vehicles. The recent charges follow another incident in which the gated community security guards are once again accused of playing cop. The felony charges were turned over to the Lake County Prosecutor's Office.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
There's no going back for seconds or thirds at the homestyle buffet restaurant, Old Country Buffet, in Highland. A favorite among seniors and those with big appetites, frugal budgets, or both, the restaurant closed at the start of the coronavirus pandemic and never reopened. The Times reports the phone number to the restaurant has been disconnected. Parent company Vita Nova Brands, which just closed an Old Country Buffet in Chicago in October, did not return messages. The Highland location was the last Old Country Buffet in the state of Indiana, according to its website.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Just after 2 weeks after reaching 5,000 confirmed COVID-19 deaths, Indiana reported its 6,000th. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports the state has averaged more than 60 deaths per day for the last 2 weeks.
The Indiana State Department of Health reported 6,109 Hoosiers are confirmed to have died from COVID-19, nearly 45% of whom have died since the state moved to Stage 5 of its reopening plan. State health officials say there are an additional 301 suspected COVID-19 deaths, where a test wasn't administered, but healthcare professionals believe the person had the virus. The rate of newly reported deaths has continued its exponential climb in the last several weeks. Indiana averaged 11 deaths per day in September, 24 in October, growing to 51 in November. ISDH has reported 511 deaths in just the last week. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb says Indiana hospitals must postpone or reschedule non-emergency surgeries for the next few weeks as COVID-19's surge worsens statewide. From at least December 16th to January 3rd, Holcomb's orders cancels elective inpatient surgeries that would have been done in the hospital. Here's State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box.
The decision to postpone non-emergent hospital procedures reflects the fact that our hospital systems are stretched to the limit.
Holcomb is also barring local health departments from waiving social gathering limits imposed by the state. So, for instance, in counties experiencing the worst COVID spread, it's 25 people or less. In the second to worst category, orange on the state's color-coded map, it's 50. Yet attendance at K through 12 extracurricular events or pro and college sporting events in orange counties can be much higher, 25% of the arena's capacity. Holcomb says that's because state data shows spread is happening in social settings like parties, weddings, and funerals.
We are picking and choosing. We're trying to do that intelligently, and we're letting the data drive those decisions.
Holcomb's latest COVID-19 executive orders run for the next few weeks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana officials say the state expects to get about 55,000 doses of a COVID-19 vaccine next week, with further amounts still unknown. Drug maker Pfizer expects to have its vaccine approved in the coming days. Indiana Health Department's Dr. Lindsay Weaver says healthcare workers and nursing home residents are top of the priority list. But she says the very first doses aren't enough to cover that entire population.
Because it is a smaller amount, that very first week, the invitation to get registered and get the vaccine is going directly to the hospitals across the state, and then we'll go to our long-term care staff.
Because initial supply is limited, Indiana is required to choose just 5 hospitals statewide that will get the first doses. Those are in Jeffersonville, Evansville, Indianapolis, Munster, and Fort Wayne. Weaver says the state will update availability as officials learn more about how much of the vaccine to expect in the coming days and weeks. She also says the state will not allow anyone under the age of 16 to get vaccinated at this time because clinical trials did not include children.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Local governments across Indiana can apply for more money from the state to help address fallout from the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The state announced Monday the third phase of its COVID-19 response program is now open for applications. The first two rounds sent more than $20 million to more than 60 communities statewide. The third round, made possible again with federal funding, will provide up to $250,000 for communities in need. The money can be used to support a variety of programs, including mental health services, child care services, public Wi-Fi locations, food pantries and food banks, and grants or loans for businesses to help retain jobs. Local governments must apply by January 29th, and communities that already received the funds can apply again.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Department of Workforce Development is trying to speed up the process for resolving disputes about unemployment eligibility by making unscheduled phone calls. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports lawyers say making the process faster could be a good thing, but worry it could have unintended consequences.
When DWD tells a person they're ineligible for unemployment benefits or that they've been overpaid benefits, that person can appeal the decision in front of a judge. But with the large amount of people appealing this year, that process has gotten severely backlogged. DWD says judges will now make unscheduled phone calls 7 days a week to workers and employers disputing an unemployment claim. Kristen Hoffman is with Indiana Legal Services, and she says they have a lot of questions about how the process will work and if it could pressure claimants to go forward without legal counsel.
They might be so desperate for benefits that they feel compelled to go forward with a hearing without adequate preparation, just because they get a phone call on a Saturday or Sunday.
DWD says if the claimants agree to waive a customary advance notice, the judge will make a decision in up to 14 days. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Attorney General Curtis Hill wants the U.S. Supreme Court to consider a lawsuit filed by the Texas Attorney General that seeks to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. That comes after Attorney General-elect Todd Rokita also urged the nation's high court to hear the case. The Texas suit aims to block results in four battleground states: Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The lawsuit relies on evidence that has been rejected by other courts at both the federal and state levels across the country. In a statement, Curtis Hill says by taking the case, the Supreme Court would help, quote, ensure the integrity of the election. Numerous officials, including U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr, say there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
It's here and now. The continued stress from COVID-19 has heightened mental health problems nationwide. And some experts say that has led to an increase in drug overdoses. Side Effects Public Media's Darian Benson reports.
With a surge in COVID-19 cases, Illinois officials are urging people to stay home. Other Midwest states, such as Indiana and Iowa, are adding restrictions to limit gatherings. That worries Brandon George, director of the Indiana Addictions Issues Coalition. He says restrictions might shut down recovery meetings for Narcotics Anonymous and other groups, just like in the spring.
We were lucky that with the seasonal timing of the first round of shutdowns,
a lot of the meetings, a lot of meeting with other people and getting that community connection, we were able to improvise and do that outside.
In winter, that might not be an option. And for people with substance use disorder, George says isolation can be deadly.
We're finding less and less safe ways to be able to interact with folks. And addiction is deadly. Alcoholism is deadly. For some people, that might be the most deadliest piece healthcare-wise for them.
Closing down businesses and issuing stay-at-home orders helped combat COVID-19. But George says that might have done more harm than good for those with substance use disorder.
The solution for one pandemic was the opposite of the solution for the overdose crisis / epidemic that we're having.
Overdose rates are increasing nationwide. In Indiana, where overdoses started to go down in 2019, emergency departments are seeing a more than 80% rise this year. And overdose deaths increased more than 30% between January and May. The pandemic has made a lot of problems worse, including depression and anxiety. And that means more people might be turning to drugs and alcohol.
There's a term, the technical term is called comorbidity. And comorbidity means patients have more than one condition, two conditions.
That's Kurt Kroenke, a researcher with the Regenstrief Institute in Indianapolis. He says this is common in people with substance use disorder.
They're at much greater risk of also suffering from depression. Probably a third to half or more also have depression as well as their problem with opiates.
Kevin Farron used drugs to cope with mental health problems. He's 23 and lives in Fishers, a suburb just north of Indianapolis.
It's kind of like a scapegoat from anything, like whether it's anxiety, anger, anything you're going through. When you do it, you just feel completely numb.
He says he got clean this year.
In May was the first time I was able to, you know, kind of like deal with my life like a normal human being would, you know, actually being able to like deal with my anxiety, sit there and, you know, get a job and be a functioning member in society.
The pandemic has made it more of a struggle. He still gets the urges that led him to drugs.
So like sitting at home, it was definitely kind of like I would have those thoughts in my head to use. But I remember I'd hit that point of sitting there saying, you know, like, I don't want to go back to what I used to do.
Kroenke is working on a study that helps treat depression and opioid use disorder simultaneously.
So, I mean, you can imagine a person who has problems with opiates and depressed, it's going to be more difficult for them to participate in treatment for their problem with opiates. And likewise, someone who's depressed is going to be less likely to be interested in decreasing their opiates.
Meanwhile, George and the Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition are preparing for the state legislators' next session in January.
COVID's not going anywhere. The overdose crisis isn't going anywhere. And we got to really make sure that we stay focused on both of those things.
They're pushing for more telehealth flexibility and an extension for the state's syringe exchange program. Those resources can help the recovery community even after the pandemic ends. From Side Effects Public Media, I'm Darian Benson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer.
Well, while 2020 may be a year that we may want to forget, there are several major financial headlines that are worth reviewing as we take a look at 2021, if anything, because we may be able to take advantage of them. Let's find out more from Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Let's start out first talking about the SECURE Act. That was something, of course, major, that along with the CARES Act, coming out of the work of trying to help alleviate some of the problems that the pandemic has brought about. Let's talk first about the SECURE Act.
Yeah, and there were several pretty significant changes in the tax laws, starting with IRA contributions. So in the prior to this act, traditional IRA contributions were not allowed if you were still working beyond the required minimum distribution age of 70 and a half. Well, now the change will expand opportunities to continue to save into traditional IRAs if you're still having earned income, still working. And it also could allow for individuals to, you know, look at a Roth IRA conversions by a backdoor strategy.
I know one of the other things, too, that came about as a result of the SECURE Act made some changes about minimum distributions from retirement accounts. And this, I guess, is all retirement accounts, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually this is a change that I like because the 70 and a half was often confusing and with some of my clients as to when or how they need to take distributions. So they made it raised the required minimum distribution age to age 72. And it's across the board. It's for your IRAs as well as your ERISA plans like your 401Ks, 403Bs, and so forth. And it allows maybe some opportunity for folks that you know have an additional year for RMDs to look at Roth conversions. Mm-hmm. But I just like the clarity a lot more than what it used to be.
Did it turn out that you've discovered through the year that when the word came out about the qualified charitable distributions, did the changes that came about from the SECURE Act turn out to be something that people took advantage of?
Yeah, and I think this is probably, again, some of the, you know, the things that, you know, need a little bit of clarity for clients. The qualified charitable distributions is the opportunity that once you reach required minimum distribution age, that you can actually have a check go directly to a charity of choice. And what that would allow you to do is not only satisfy required minimum distributions if you wanted to do that, but also it would allow for a top-line deduction on your tax return. So instead of having to go through the itemized deduction process, which for a lot of folks in this age group, it's very hard to get outside of the standard deduction. You can now take those distributions that go directly to those charities and take them as a straight deduction off your income. So for folks that are charitably minded, it's a great opportunity to actually, you know, get the deduction back for the contributions they're making to charitable organizations.
Well, I know that 2020 was also a year where we saw changes in some of the stretch IRAs in particular and how the changes came about as far as payments concerned for beneficiaries. Tell us more about that and the benefits that people who decided to look into that will get.
Yeah, this is probably one of the biggest changes that, you know, I feel came about because of the SECURE Act. Because in the past, if you were to inherit an IRA, with the exception of a spouse is still allowed to do an assumption under the current laws. But anybody outside of a spouse used to be able to create an inherited IRA, and they could stretch those payments over their lifetime, i.e., the stretch terminology. So there was an age-based table that specified the minimum amounts that you had to distribute, and as long as you pertained to that, you could keep that money in that account. Now, you could always take more for those that wanted to take more, but it gave you the opportunity to control the taxes a little bit. Now, they have eliminated that opportunity, and the IRA that you inherit must be, the balance must be completely removed by the end of the 10 years or after death. Mm-hmm. So it does, for a lot of folks, escalate the time or, the amount of money that they have to take out of that IRA and shorten the time frame, which could definitely create a lot of tax impact. So when it comes to tax planning, even increases the significance more of taking advantage of things like the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and looking at mitigating some of those taxes.
Okay, we took a look now at the Secure Act. Let's take a look at the CARES Act now. With the changes that came about there, what are some of the things that we can note from 2020 that we might be able to keep in our minds as we plan for 2021?
Yeah, and a lot of this CARES Act was basically a direct response to the pandemic, as we know, mm-hmm. and it just simply allowed, for lack of a better term, relief in certain situations. One, because there was a lot of volatility in March and things going on with the market and people concerned about having to take required minimum distributions off of higher values when their accounts were down, they allowed people to waive the required minimum distribution amount for the 2020 year. And then that, again, goes across the board not only to IRAs but to SEPs, simples, 401Ks, 403Bs, the whole gamut of ERISA plans.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you mentioned here the fact that, of course, the CARES Act was centered around the coronavirus impact on people's finances. What are some of the issues that are involved with distributions that we should make note of that may have to account for maybe in 2021?
Yeah, so there was a relief within the CARES Act that would allow folks or individuals that were diagnosed, either themselves or a spouse, with
right.
the COVID-19 virus, but they also had to experience adverse financial consequences, being furloughed, laid off, having work hours reduced, unable to work, or closing reducing hours of the business. So clients who would qualify under that guideline were allowed the opportunity to take distributions from their qualified plans, a total aggregate of up to $100,000. And again, that included IRAs as well as ERISA plans. And the special relief would allow them to avoid the 10% early distribution penalty, but also created the opportunity to spread the tax liability over 3 years. And in addition to that, the opportunity to go ahead and repay that distribution over those 3 years and then get refunded the tax liabilities that they spread out. So very, very flexible opportunity for those that were impacted financially from the coronavirus to be able to utilize some of their assets and then have the opportunity, hopefully, to put it back in mm-hmm. so they're, don't hurt their retirement.
Now, as we get near the end of 2020 and look to 2021, we know that at least the first of the year we'll start having to deal with the filling out the tax returns for this year, for 2020, actually in 2021. But are you finding now, especially with some of your clients, that you have to start going through everything that's happened here in this year and remind them about them and kind of readjust things so that when it's time to get the returns ready to go, that they'll be ready for it?
Oh, yeah, there's definitely a lot of changes that have occurred in the tax laws this year as well as the last couple of years. And what we anticipate to be changes, given the suspected political change, they're talking about repealing the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So, yeah, I think more so than ever now, looking to a professional to give guidance within your tax preparation is as significant as it's been in the last several years because, a lot of the things that you need to be aware of, could be manual inputs. We're not sure how the software is going to handle it. We're not sure, how the treatment would be. I suspect, Chris, that there'll be a lot of confusion going into this tax season. So just validates the need for folks that are in the know to help those that, don't have the time or really the desire to go explore and figure everything out on their own.
Yeah, I imagine this is going to be a very busy year for you and other financial advisors going into 2021 here, when it's time to start getting the information at least all together so that the tax returns can be worked on.
Oh, and there's still confusion. There's still confusion around how the PPP loans are going to be treated, whether the tax brackets are going to be changed next year, the following year, if at all, or if the repeal is going to be 2025. Yeah, so the Roth conversions this year have been hectic, to say the least, but we're happy to have the opportunity to help people, you know, kind of disseminate this information and find value where there's value and you know, utilize it for what it's meant to be used for.
Well, it sounds like a busy time coming up for not only you and other colleagues in trying to help clients sort all this out and maybe try and do better planning for 2021?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, actually, we're excited about it because anytime there's change, we can create value. So we're looking forward to it and continuing to provide that information for our clients.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.